Welcome to the Digital Engagement Forecast. Our recent guests included Allison Kappen and a few other folks whose profiles might be known to a lot of our audience. I think this is our highest profile guest yet. He actually has his own Wikipedia entry, Brian. Can you imagine that?
Is that true?
Yeah.
Did we look that up while he was on?
Oh, I definitely looked. That's part of my
standard. We should have had him read his own Wikipedia entry.
I think he was... He would have demurred, I'm sure. Anyway, Nathaniel, obviously done a lot in the space. Most people will recognize his name, know him as the founder of NGP Van, and also who's CTO for the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign in 2008. But today's seems to be more of a soulful, thoughtful guy, not a captain of industry, but someone who's seeking enlightenment.
Lots of walking and chopping of wood.
Yeah. Yeah, and but just a deep thinker who I think had a really, really great conversation with him. The conversation was not powered by Charity Engine because it was done in the middle of the day, so we did not have our usual alcohol to help warm us up as the host anyway.
We need our non-alcoholic beverage sponsor.
Yeah, if anybody out there, any tea companies, any coffee companies want to get their name out
there. Any Charity Engine competitors.
Yeah, or any other Charity Engine executives who want to corner the market here.
We're going to sponsor all meals. Yeah. We're going to get a lunch sponsor, a dinner sponsor.
But we'll mention Charity Engine anyway. Who are they, Brian?
Charity Engine. If your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
That's charityengine.net, and here's our conversation with Nathaniel. Looked at your LinkedIn page, and you've got four jobs that are concurrent. So it's like January 2009 to present, July 2012 to present. So you're doing Lover Fund, Graphicacy, Time Plots, and NGP Van all concurrently. But it sounds like some of them it's less of an active role, huh?
Well, and those are not the only things, I guess. I'm trying to have a portfolio of interesting activities. My feeling is good projects ongoing is equivalent to happiness. So I try to do things like that. Yeah.
Do you ever have a problem dividing your time between all these interests?
What I try to do, sure, like everybody else, I have trouble because any particular thing can expand to be all of your time.
Yeah.
I try to find people to work with who I can trust, who can take a lot of responsibility so that I don't have to. And that works out fairly well.
When did you make that leap going from, like, I'm building a company and working at it to you're taking a much more executive role and being able to delegate and not get bogged down?
Well, it was a very gradual process. So when I started NGP Software, it was just me for 2.5 years. So it was hard to rely on anyone else. And I worked through the first several score clients doing all the programming, all the support for Democratic political campaign
software. So was it literally
software.
Just you? Like you decided
just me.
To
nope.
hang up a shingle? And
Yep. Wrote the software, started selling it, worked out of my attic of my house. And about 2.5 years in, the support calls were really driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. And so I hired Lou Levine, who's still there, as my first employee. And the two of us worked for 2.5 years together, him doing the support and learning to code on the software, and took quite a while. That was a long, slow build, but it was a really thriving business model by the time we started to hire.
And that was all bootstrapped. It was all your own money.
I lent the company $10,000 and lived off of whatever I could get paid by clients the rest of the way. Yeah, mm-hmm. never took any money until I sold some of it.
And I'm following down this line of inquiry because Anne mentioned that one of your passions these days is sort of the concept of entrepreneurship.
Definitely. I mean, I'm not one of these people who grew up wanting to run a business. I didn't start this one till after I left graduate school, NGP. But along the way, it became something that, well, that company was very obsessive. I put a lot into it and got really interested in small business over the course of 12 years of building and running that.
Was there a point when you went from spending 90% of your time, you know, doing billable work and dealing with the software to, you know, separating yourself and focusing on marketing and that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, like I was saying, it was gradual. So when it was just me, I had all these roles. And then as I hired other people to do things like support or the programming or the sales or product management, all of those pieces, then I could abstract myself out of it. But that probably, you know, it probably took 6 or 7 years to get a good start on being able to leave the company to itself, and wasn't until I sold it that it was totally that way. But it was pretty close for several years before.
See, I've been doing that for 14 years, so I'm like somewhere along year 7, I must have taken a wrong turn.
No, I don't think it's a wrong turn. I think there's the you know, being in the business can be very, very in your business, if you love what you're doing, can be very fulfilling, and that's a great road. I'm kind of happy about the path I took, where I was able to do more strategic things and start talking to other entrepreneurs and think about the business strategically, mm-hmm. and then try other things ultimately.
Is that because that was the next challenge and you were bored, or was that because that's what you needed to make it get bigger? Like, was there a driving impetus, or is it just more organic? Like, you just kind of...
I mean, what I think is that I remember we had a 10th anniversary party at the National Press Club, and there was a lot of guests,
a lot of clients. Like an expensive party.
It was for the scale of the company, it wasn't, and I'm always pretty thrifty, but you know, it was a nice party, and we, you know, but that day I was thinking, it's been about 10 years, I might want to do new things, and I started to think about selling it then, and by 2 years later, I had found a way to do that. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
Well, so some of your interests these days, Graphicacy. Brian and I went to a party you guys had with a baseball trivia challenge the other day. Yeah. That was fun. And I was playing around with some of the stuff on your website. Is that something that's an abiding passion of yours, this graphically presenting data?
So when I was in college and I was a senior, I took a class with Ed Tufte, who many people know as a kind of guru of quantitative display of visual display of quantitative information.
Got his book on my shelf somewhere.
He's got a number of really fine books, and I thought along the way of various projects that I'd like to tackle that were maybe inspired by some of the work that he collected or did. But you know, grad school and building NGP software and various other things like children kept me from doing that. But then in around 2009, I started to have more freedom. And so I started this company, Time Plots, because for me, maybe projects belong inside a company and you can see whether anyone else likes them or not by trying to sell them. And so I built this visual history of the Supreme Court of the United States. It's a huge poster. And just to see whether I enjoyed doing that and whether it would meet with good feedback. So that's kind of
was this your attempt to develop a product, or was this your attempt to follow a passion and just maybe try to scale it?
No, my idea was to start a company that did things like that. And so we started selling it.
But the root is never, hey, I'm going to do this for fun, or you know, it was the platform you were using was a for-profit startup company.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of things I do for fun or for free, but that particular project, I wanted a company to do it, and I wanted to sell a bunch of them, and I had the idea to do 50 or 100. That's not what ultimately happened, but we've done many.
Yeah, I saw the Death and Taxes
The Death and Taxes is actually not, it's the one poster on that, on our roster that I acquired because I liked what the guy who built it was doing, and he was going to abandon it, so I kind of have taken that on, and we've rebuilt it every year. So it's a little franchise.
I'm really curious about how you find a market for those posters. Do you have people coming to you saying we want to
you know, sponsor, you know, government spending poster, or are you just finding something that you think there's an audience for and
so
prototyping from there?
So we have done a couple things. So we have done commissioned posters for companies like or other entities that want to tell their story mm-hmm. in that format. But what came out of Time Plots and Information Graphic Products was this other company, Graphicacy, which is really the same team, which consults and provides services to other groups that want to tell their story in visual form. So we, and mostly that's turned out to be interactive work. That's turned out to be, you know, there's some print design and static infographics or whatever, but mainly that's been, we have a data set or we have a report or we have a ranking or we have something that is a collection of data and we want to abstract the story out of it.
Boring if you just
it could be and so we want to turn that into something which you can interact with that's motion graphics or that's interactive graphics and so on.
That strikes me as brilliant for Washington and a lot of the clients that you and I probably share, which is, you know, they're every second about storytelling, but they don't necessarily have access to a lot of real stories. So you've got to generate interest in, you know, the resources that you have, which is a lot of this policy research, which maybe has been, you know, kind of like all of our clients, a lot of the creative work we do is we're releasing a report. How do we get people to care at all beyond the 10 people over at the Department of whatever who read it? Yeah. How do I make this accessible to the general public?
And my attitude is I like clients who want to tell an honest story. I think a lot of times you struggle with clients who want to polish too much and only give one side. And I think that it's much more effective to look at real data and to make the best case using real information. And that doing that, it gets past a lot of people out there's resistance to always being marketed to. So, you know,
if the bullshit meter is if suddenly they detect something that's, oh, they're not being straightforward, right.
Like we did a project for Center for American Progress about immigration, and they had a couple professors write a paper, and it was a complicated PDF with a lot of footnotes. And, you know, the challenge was, how do I get more than 40 people to read this, like you were suggesting? And so we turned that into 4 interactives and a motion graphic video that was very much about metaphor and about, you know, taking the message up to the highest level, but also mm-hmm. letting people explore the data and see for themselves that, look, you know, we are going to actually need more immigrants to fill all the jobs of retiring baby boomers over the next few decades. The real data and real projections make the case for mm-hmm. liberal immigration policy, not for some of the counter arguments that you might hear in the press lately or among mm-hmm. Republican presidential candidates, for example.
Have you ever been inconvenienced by the data in that somebody has commissioned you and you're kind of unpacking it and you're like, this does not bode well for the story you want to tell?
We absolutely have, and it's been a struggle with, we had a client that was in the community college space, and they provided a number of services to a lot of community colleges, and they wanted us to show the effect of their services on various variables. And when we looked at the real data, at least the data that they were able to collect, most of the lines were flat or didn't show any impact. It makes it extremely difficult to tell the story that they wanted to tell from that data. And we made many proposals of concepts, and they didn't want to go forward with most of them. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a way to do that, to go to do things anecdotally, and because they were having impact. Sometimes, you know, just because it's not in the data it means you're not collecting the right data. What's more exciting to us is if we can be brought in very early in the process to help people understand what the right data is to collect, to help look, you know, to really think about what the campaign is you want to make around this, and not just think of us as technicians, but think of us as partners who can think alongside you in and help you make a case.
Are there some guide rules to what makes good data or what makes visually compelling data?
Well, I don't know if I have a list of guidelines, but I think, you know, what is helpful is if you're talking about impact, if you, let's say you have a timeline and you can see a dose, you can say, look, at this point, we made a regulation outlawing lead in the atmosphere, and we had measurements of lead in the atmosphere before and after, and you can see a step change in the graph. I mean, that's a pretty compelling visual, you know, and that can be done in a sentence, but it can be done way better with well-collected data that you can see, hey, there's something really going on here. And it's much more exciting if it's more complicated and yet you can show something dramatic by choosing the right variables and displaying them in the right way and putting things in context.
You put the little squiggly line to show a big jump in the scale on the vertical axis so that your curve is steeper.
No, I mean I'm really opposed to trying to use tricks to advocate something. I think most people who are, say, in advocacy believe strongly in what they're doing and ought to have data that shows that what they're doing matters. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to work alongside with them to actually show that.
So clearly you care a little bit about the stuff you're doing. I mean, the clients you're serving are people who are probably largely progressive organizations doing policy work, Washington, D.C. kind of stuff. Is that something that's motivated you throughout?
Well, you know, NGP was, I made a decision when I started it in the campaign software arena that I would only work with the Democratic candidates. And
is that
parties.
Kind of how that space is, though? It wasn't
when I started. Yeah. It's become more that way. But I think I was pretty instrumental in helping to change the way that space was organized on the technology side. Yeah. So we beat a lot of other companies early on that were bipartisan. There was a mix, but I think we changed the model there quite a bit. When I started Time Plots and Graphicacy, I was kind of happy not to put myself in a straitjacket about the kinds of clients I chose. Clearly my own network is in the progressive space and a lot of my heart is there, but I'm happy to work with good companies that have interesting projects or, I'm not making it ideological, what Graphicacy does.
So your work, in Graphicacy then sounds like in terms of all of your children, this is the one that is your favorite at this point?
No. I think when one has children, as I do have two daughters, one wants to not play favorites among them. I love my two daughters equally. I tell them both they're my favorite. And so I'm also working on this nonprofit called Lever Fund, which you mentioned. Uh-huh. That's another good child that we just hired an executive director for.
It's a full-time position.
Greg Cork is the new full-time executive director of that. I'm very hopeful that's going to be something that has impact on the greater DC area in poverty fighting. And I'm doing some coaching of small businesses around the area. I'm rooting for them. You know,
there's
lots of projects I have that I think are important, but Graphicacy is a big thing, something I care a lot about.
Well, and the coaching, you're sitting on boards or you're... I've been
on consulting. Advisory boards other types of boards. I like that. But also just informally, sometimes paid and paid well and sometimes for free for friends. And I've done some investing in companies that I believe in. It's been fun learning from other people in different arenas.
So when someone asks you, what do you do for a living when you're having that conversation, you meet someone, what's your answer?
Well, I had my staff at Graphicacy design me a business card that has many email addresses and many logos. And I call it my multi-card, and I I pass them that.
You need a cube where you could just have six sides.
You know, there is a side of me that misses the NGP days where I had one chief passion that I thought about in the shower and woke up in the middle of the night worrying about and so on. But I also am, for this period of my life, enjoying the multiplicity of projects.
And you don't feel like things are slipping through the cracks because you're just not able to devote enough time?
I honestly, at the end of most of my days, I look back at the day and say, wow, I did a lot of interesting stuff today. It was very varied. I had a lunch with somebody I never met before and learned from them. Mm. I went to an entrepreneur forum and got a lot out
Except
of that.
Except for that goddamn podcast. What a pain in the ass.
Actually, I'm enjoying this experience too.
Is this your first podcast?
I've been interviewed, but I'm not really sure what the difference is between a podcast and some other kind of recording. So we could call this. I know that there's another one. That
you should listen to our very first podcast, because that's pretty much what the discussion was what makes a podcast a podcast. And I think there are some.
I've listened to a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, when I walk a lot, that's one of my other things I'm crazy about. And I listened to a lot while
on the
doing
mall
it.
At night, according to your Facebook page.
And all through the parks and many other places.
I think the podcast thing for us, it feels like a structure that's not like if you go on a panel before an audience, which you've probably done 1,000 times, like at a conference, you have a very limited amount of time. You have to spend half of it thanking people and qualifying all your answers, and because you're speaking to this very broad audience. But this is a format that is very intimate and completely unstructured. You have podcasts like the This American Life or some radio show that just happens to be serialized online. It's delivered in a podcast format, but it's not really a podcast. It's a produced show. A podcast to me is like having a beer.
Is it pod as in iPod? What's the pod in the podcast?
That's a good question.
That's it? Yeah.
Yeah. I know it was Adam Curry, the MTV VJ, who allegedly came up with the data structure for what a feed is.
You have to think back to the original iPods. It was a big deal. If you watch Silicon Valley, they have the guy that talks about, I brought ROI, Radio Online. It's like podcasts were, is a novel concept, but when people could actually walk around and have these pre-recorded shows that weren't radio shows, some of them were, but for the most part, they were real conversations, and carry those around in their pocket. Suddenly, you had a very personal relationship, right? It's strange. I haven't met anybody that I've listened to their podcast for a long time, but I imagine that, I've listened to some podcasts for 10 plus years. I imagine when, one of those people passes on, because some of them are really old, or maybe they're going to do a live show in DC and I go see them, it's going to be weird. There's not a lot of things where you pay attention to the subject matter for a decade or more and not be connected with them.
Do you think there's something lost by not having the visual? When I look at you guys in this gorgeous office, two incredibly handsome men talking on this microphone, I feel like maybe someone's losing something, not seeing the two.
Are you telling me I look better than I sound?
I think it's a matter of how you consume it, which is consume it when I walk the dog to work and back every day. And so I can't be looking at a video. And frankly, just to show the three of us in a room talking to each other, I don't know that
might be a little bit boring.
Yeah, but if we could supplement it with here's the baseball time plot product, and here's this, but that would take a lot of work. To get back to your earlier question,
it just seems like a good method, and it feels pretty comfortable.
We've been also a little selfish. I think we're doing what we want. If we start having listeners that say, we want video, maybe.
So, what do you think makes a good guest for a podcast?
I personally like tangents. I like, you mentioned grad school earlier. We haven't even talked about what'd you major in? I like when we have these guests and we go off on, you know, one of our guests is talking about like a road trip through Alaska, right? On its surface, doesn't necessarily have any connection to the story, but then we start, you know, bringing it all back. And for me, it's all about learning about that person as much as it's learning about what they do.
The most compelling moments, I think, are when you start to dive into just stories that have nothing to do with kind of the topic that we're sort of structuring the podcast around. Because that's when, like, I'm actually listening and I forget that I'm, like, asking questions and trying to, like, elicit certain responses and stuff.
Like, I can Google Graphicacy and find out what it does, but... Yeah. You know, we have learned a little bit about how some of these companies got started. You're juggling several at the same time. Like, that, those are things that, you know, you can't just learn from a quick Google search.
Yeah, and actually it's the thing I least like talking about in a certain sense is, like, what is your company and what does it do and trying to sell it? I find that I don't enjoy that particularly. I like – there's certainly many things within those companies or other things that I'm doing that – can get me excited to talk about it, but just, you know, going on to talk about, like, being on a panel like I was for many years for NGP, I kind of dreaded those appearances because it just felt like I was performing a particular role, and I didn't have a lot of freedom to be myself.
Well, the one thing that, speaking of passions, that I've been waiting to ask you about is this documentary film. I don't know if Anne was supposed to tell me about this, but what are you putting together exactly?
Well, so yeah, among the projects I didn't mention, back when I started to disentangle myself from NGP, I decided one of the things I wanted to learn about was how to make a movie, and I knew about as little about it as you can imagine. It's kind of like when I started the company, I didn't know anything about running a business either. And so I became friends with two brothers, Lance and Brandon, who run Meridian Hill Pictures here in D.C.
Yeah.
At the time, they didn't have a company. And I think
over by Meridian Hill?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And they're, in fact, they've just recently released their first full-length documentary called City of Trees, which is quite good if anyone wants to see it.
City of Trees, Washington, D.C.?
Yep. It's about a really interesting project that the Forest Service originally commissioned with them to track a grant that they did. And I probably am not the right person to characterize.
Is this related to Casey Trees at all?
No, it's related to a job training program that they followed in detail that was trying to upgrade the parks and train people how to get jobs doing landscaping type stuff. Uh-huh. And it's a lovely movie that took, you know, it's taken them 4 years to make, but it's quite good. But anyway, I worked with Lance and Brandon, and I wanted to make a movie about entrepreneurship. And so, but what I really wanted, I figured the way to start was just to start interviewing entrepreneurs. And so we went to various states, we picked interesting businesses and talked to quite a number of people about the founding, kind of like what
did
you've done.
Did you
with
have
me.
More of a game plan than that, or was it really like, I'm just going to dip my toe in the water and start to kind of germinate this idea?
Well, you know, I kind of took it from the way you build software nowadays. I wanted to do it in an agile way, which is a really bad idea probably for making a movie, but... Mm-hmm. Because I was doing it with really on the cheap, and I had time, and I wanted to learn. I figured I'm not necessarily needing to keep anything that I'm doing, but I got to learn how to interview people. I've got to get a sense, because I was like shy about that. I didn't know how it would feel to be on camera with somebody else, to like be asking them details of how they built something. And I was looking for people, perhaps like me, who had found a way to create an enterprise that they loved, that fit with their life, that I could admire. Because I was kind of looking for the next thing to do.
Were you looking for the answer? Is this like a search for the Holy Grail? Like, I've found the key to entrepreneurship?
No, I mean, the idea was to follow me as I explored my next steps. So there's a lot of following me in it. And I was unsure if that was a good way to do it because I'm not sure that I'm like the actor to carry some.
So you're not having screaming matches with people and kicking them out of your kitchen and stuff.
But they were interesting. But they're interesting people. Like I picked popcorn with a organic farmer in Dover, Mass, who does a vegetable subscription service, who was one of the pioneers in that. It was just different, very interesting people, a bronze forge in Chester, Pennsylvania, that serves all these sculptors, and watching them pour the bronze into forms, and you know, just all kind of a broad array of interesting characters. And we have some great footage, you know, a wonderful woodworker up in Vermont. And,
so your buddies over at Meridian Hill are probably asking you where the conflict is. What's the...
Well, I mean, we have definitely struggled about what is going
tension,
to make this...
conflict.
What's the narrative arc?
Yeah.
You know, what's the story that would make this worth watching? Which is why it hasn't been completed and why it's sort of sitting, waiting for that spark of inspiration. So, you know, you can ask me about it, but it's a success for me in the sense that I've learned a lot. It's not a success in the sense of getting something done.
Well, I don't think you plan to do documentary with the sense that you're going to be making money.
Well, no, and I was never about making money, but I still am holding out the idea that someday I can make something out of some of it that would be valuable in some form, whether it's going up on the internet as shorts about some of the people I interviewed or I don't know what form it will take. It would be cool if it became a full-length thing.
What are you learning from this stuff? Is there anything that's changed the way you look at things or the way you proceed through running your businesses?
Well, I think what I'm learning is that life has a great deal of freedom if you choose to approach it that way. And that if you feel like it, you can find a way, as I've seen lots of people without a lot of resources, create something out of whole cloth. And there are tons of directions with which to do that. The barriers are much lower than people think. That it's kind of a matter of picking something, trying it, staying with it, you know, being resilient when it doesn't work. I mean, I'm sure you've learned this in your, what you said, 14 years of running this enterprise. Like, it is...
I don't know. I feel like all I see are barriers. And I'm being totally honest about that. And maybe I'm just burnt out. But all I see is, like, every day it's like there's five more fucking problems I got to fix.
Well, I think I think we've all been there. But I think that might mean that it's time to change the direction a little bit, and you have the freedom to do that.
I mean, you got to give us notice if you're.
I mean,
I'll give you 6 weeks.
You know,
thank you.
Everybody I've spent a lot of time with business owners. I wouldn't have thought going in that I would, but in the last bunch of years, that's what I spent a lot of time talking to people in your shoes about it. It is a little lonely sometimes, and it is a struggle, but it's also like compare it to other jobs. You know, compare it to working for somebody else and having less leeway to make your own day and to change direction. It is a wonderful thing. And you can decide, hey, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah. Or you can have someone else run it for you. I mean, there are lots of...
Brian, what are you doing in the next couple of years?
I think I'm going to run Foresight. Sounds like.
I mean,
should I get the dog? Can we keep Lucky?
Oh, that's the first thing I'm giving you.
I think...
Comes with the office.
Taking one little step after another in a direction that you want is a good thing to do.
Well, I think most people are afraid of that freedom. And I mean, the reason I do it is because I value that above all else, is the ability to like define, you know, my next step and not be encumbered by any kind of, you know, structure. But, you know, the options then become, you know, innumerable, and the ability to sort of like enjoy the process of saying like, there's my goal and I'm going to take steps that direction. I think that's a daunting thing, which I'm not really good at. But the people who are successful that I've seen seem to be.
So let me take the opportunity to tell you about a project that I worked on this summer, since you said you like tangents.
Yeah.
And this is a project that I did, which certainly was not for pay, and certainly would probably be viewed as odd by some. But I've had the luck of spending the last bunch of summers up in Vermont for about 2.5 months, and my parents have land up there, which I used to go to as a kid. They were teachers, so we had the summer up there. They got it very inexpensively back in 1967. And so we have a little house up there, and I decided, I've been exploring the woods that we have for some years. And there was a place back, we have maybe, near 100 acres. There's a place back in the woods that I always kind of liked. I'd been clearing along rock walls to expose them, and I'm like, this place could be a park, but it's a mess. There's all these trees lying down dead in the middle of it, limbs. It could stand being cleaned up, and it's probably an area about an acre.
But this is like, you're talking like the settlers who first came to Vermont having to cut down all the trees, and like, this is a lot of labor. It's not just raking a little plot of grass.
And so like across the middle were a series of 50, 60 foot trees that had blown over, for example, one over another. And so I like using a chainsaw. I like dragging brush. I like cleaning things up. So I would wake up 6 a.m., walk out, is about 6/10 of a mile away from the house, walk up the hill to this place, and start just dragging branches from this area outside of this area into piles, and carrying, cutting long branches up into logs and dragging them out. And I have a tractor with a winch on it, and I figured out how to get it through the woods to close to this area. And I would pull out, bigger trees out of this. And so I spent a lot of time over the summer.
Are you a Buddhist?
No. I'm not, just sweating, and a couple hours in the morning of hard labor for no purpose other than sort of this vision of making a park. I think when I was doing that, I was thinking, this is an absolute metaphor for any project that you might work on. There's something about like slogging away at something with a vision that can be inspiring to you. And this isn't for view of anybody else. This was kind of, a little bit private.
What motivates your work and what makes it enjoyable, though, is that vision. It's not I can maximize revenue, or it's driven internally.
For me, it's best when it is. And I never, like when I built NGP, I never set revenue goals. I never was worried. I was interested in getting clients. I wanted to get all of the Democratic congressmen. I wanted to get all the Democratic senators.
So you had benchmarks.
I wouldn't say they were benchmarks, but they were something to celebrate. I was competitive. I wanted to beat other firms, and I wanted to serve those clients well, and I wanted to support them well. But that was not, it was not about making money to me. It was nice that I could bring in money and pay good people to work alongside me. And it was definitely enjoyable when there was enough left over at the end of the year to take it out. And there certainly wasn't in the early years, and there certainly was in the later years. But yeah, I've been much happier when for some reason some project fit me. And sometimes that's hard to figure out why it is. Why would I like dragging logs around? Because I've done that kind of thing for many summers, and it's like tied to my childhood or whatever.
So is that a way to frame your various interests now? Is you're sort of casting a bunch of nets and following your interests where they may take you?
I think I'm running a number of experiments in areas that intrigue me, and I'm lucky to be able to there's certainly like clients that you get that are frustrating that you might wish you could fire. And there's certainly bottom lines, like when you have people that you need to pay, there's choices that have to be made that are very mundane or crass. But if you can sort of have that longer term vision about, hey, I want to build an enterprise that is a place for really good people to work, that's furthering our clients' goals, that is doing something aesthetically pleasing, that, you know, then I think you're on the right path. It feels good.
And that's in your conversations for your documentary with other entrepreneurs. You've seen this reflected back at you when they talk about their work?
The ones that I admire often can say that much more elegantly than I was just able to. And, you know, you can see very often whether someone has found some kind of alignment between what they're doing and what is inside them. And, you know, like I think of this guy, Garrett Hack, this woodworker in New York, in Vermont, who's a really fine woodworker. He has sort of three legs to his business. He makes commission pieces that are top notch. He teaches other woodworkers around the world how to do, you know, high-end things, and he writes about woodworking for Fine Woodworking magazine. And he lives in a beautiful place in a studio that he built out of old bricks and things like that on a nice farm that he still uses an old horse to manage. He's created a life around his work that seems to be a good fit for him. And it's hard when he talks about that not to admire it or be envious of it or think that he's on the right path.
Well, your definition of success is a lot different than maybe what you would if I was going to do that article about, you know, interviews with successful entrepreneurs, I would go and I would see, like, what's your annual revenue and how many people have you employed and how quickly have you grown, sort of more of a venture capitalist kind of assessment of what makes a successful entrepreneur. But you're defining it much more broadly.
Well, I mean, perhaps. I did talk to people who had... I talked to a guy who sold a software company for, I think, $45 million and had started a dueling piano enterprise after that and was having a lot of fun with it. I mean, I think...
Like success, he built pianos with two keyboards?
No, it's like two different pianists dueling with each other. But, I mean, I think the point is success is... My definition of success shouldn't be imposed on someone else. Yeah. Everyone should have their own that fits them. And I might have my opinion about whether theirs makes sense or not.
So there is, among us 30-somethings, there's a trend that a lot of us still don't know what the hell we're doing in our life, which growing up, it was always the idea that, you know, you had those people that were going to go work the same job until the day they retired. But the most interesting people didn't know what they were going to do with their life. What I've found concerning, though, is that now that I've gotten here, most people that I know are in that category. And suddenly it's not the novelty of, like, oh, that wanderer, that person that, you know, has a lot of jobs and, you know, travels quite often. That's almost everybody I know. Almost no one has had a job for, you know, since they've been out of high school or envisions having the same job for 10 plus years. What was that like? Did you stay connected with some of your high school, college friends, or other people you've worked with over the years? And are you the black sheep of the group, the one that keeps going, keeps innovating, keeps finding where they can find that new passion? Or have you surrounded yourself with similar people?
So I'm very fortunate that I still have a lot of friends from first grade, from high school, from college, from grad school, and from NGP and other companies. And I couldn't possibly paint them all with one brush. I think I'm a little older than you folks. I'm 50 now. And maybe when I think quickly about, like, my college friends, that a lot of them are in jobs that have been pretty career oriented. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're professors. And I think most of them are doing well at that and enjoying their lives and raising children or not, and kind of growing. Through my work and through, you know, kind of entrepreneurship groups around DC, I've definitely spent a lot of time with people who've built companies. And then I've certainly spent a lot of time with employees, some of whom are millennials or whatever, who are more in the category of trying lots of different things. And I've spent time talking to them about that. I understand that. I think I feel a lot of kinship with that. I personally do, maybe to answer your question better. I think I got really fortunate that I think I make a bad employee. I don't think I like being an employee. I think I don't have, you know, there's a lot of things that are not my strengths, that showing up for work at 9 a.m., working for someone else throughout the day and leaving at 5 is not a good fit. And I've had sort of what you might call bad employees who are like that, who I feel like I can understand. And sometimes it's hard to manage people like that, but I think maybe I'm advantaged by being like them a little bit. I don't know. A rambling answer to your question.
I had the same
reaction.
It was
a rambling question.
when Brian made that comment, I sort of had the same question for you, which was like, if everybody followed your prescription, then, you know, you'd have a lot of cooks in the kitchen and you'd have, you know.
Well, I don't think my
nobody who would show up and do the work.
I don't think my prescription is for everybody. I think I've diagnosed myself with a condition called, which I don't believe is a real one, but it's called a resistant personality. Like, if you ask me to do something, I'm less likely to want to do it in some ways. Like, and I think I have a...
It's all got to be a casual ask.
I don't know. I have like a daughter
like
that.
How does your wife deal with that?
My wife really suffers with that, I think, because we have a daughter like that too. And I think that works well as an entrepreneurial personality, but it's not... but we need all types in order to build a firm. And like, I was really lucky in that a lot of people I worked with filled different roles than I did and made up for my deficits, and maybe I was able to help them as well.
Well, I mean, part of growing any company is, and this is something that, you know, we're, you know, keenly interested in. We hired, what, 4 people this year? Mm-hmm. Hiring the right people. So how – talk about some of those early days or – not necessarily at NGP, but starting other companies and getting those first few hires and the success and trials of that. You know, how did you get good at finding the right people for the right positions?
You know, it's really hard to separate good and lucky. You know, I think I'm kind of known for being a non-standard interviewer and putting people on their heels a little bit and asking questions that wouldn't be expected. But I'm not sure I'm not sure how helpful that is. I really try to assess people and not be blinded by resume items. But I do look for smart people, and I think I look for people who are attracted to the mission of what I'm doing. And I think that's been helpful. I think one of the other things is, if you have a core of people who are really into what you do and are working hard, that they sort of teach each other. And so I brought other employees always into the hiring process. And we have a tradition at NGP, at least like in the support area and different departments, where somebody gets interviewed by a group. And so you have a variety of opinions about who you're hiring. And it's kind of that way you're, you know, it's a company decision to hire, not just the boss or just one leader of a group. I think that's helpful too. But I don't think everyone gets it right. So I think part of it also is, when you make the mistake, how do you make the move to ease that person out in timely fashion who was a mistake and is not a fit, maybe not through a total fault of their own, but because it just, they don't get along with everybody else, or they don't have the right work ethic, or they aren't who they appeared to be.
Or maybe more importantly, how do you retain the good people?
Retaining, yeah.
These millennials who want to change their job after they've been there.
I think that is it's really hard to keep good people.
Do you consciously do that? Do you sit down and say, here's my plan for retention? Or is it just like,
I think it's,
I want this company to be an extension of my values and I'll try to, you know, make sure that everybody else can benefit from that.
I you know, I've always been hyper aware of the relationship between me and an employee being two directional, and that employment is like when you hire someone, you kind of feel like you're doing them a favor. And when they take the job, they kind of feel like they're doing you a favor. And both things are true. And to continue the relationship along the way with mutual respect and trying to put yourself in the place of people working with you. I try to say with you, not for you, you know. How do I make this a place that this person's going to continue to want to work in? What, you know, and I don't think, you know, can I raise their wage in timely fashion? That could be part of it, but I don't think that's the biggest part of it. You know, can I figure out where they want to go with their life and help them grow within this company so that that's being taken care of in that way? But I think also you have to recognize that, you know, I've had people work like Lou for NGP for, I don't know, what's 15 years now or something. A lot of our early employees are still there because they kind of got the bug of the company and feel like it. But other people worked for 5 years for me. That's a large chunk of your life. And then went on to other things. I think you want to celebrate that also and try to stay in touch with them and still be friends. And so we've had multiple employees leave, do other jobs, and then come back because we maintain that relationship. And then, of course, we've lost people that we'd rather not have lost.
So we talked about the passion that it takes and what motivates you and the keeping employees. Are there any other key sort of lessons about being an entrepreneur or running a company that come to mind?
I think if you asked that question with some more specific area, I probably would have tons of things to say.
So you're not writing a book and these are my three key points.
I'm really bad at
three things every entrepreneur needs to
do.
I think I have a hard time marketing this documentary.
I think
BuzzFeed.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably true. I'm not so good at the ABCD list. Ask me the question in some more specific way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also conscious of the time here, and
just edit that part out.
I just want to make sure you had an opportunity to get across all of your, you know, passion around this topic as you can. One thing, speaking of passion, we like to do is we like to ask people if there are any nonprofit organizations that they've worked with or they've come in contact with that could use a little bit more attention and could. You know, if you want to call them out now by name and by URL and entice other people who might be listening to support them.
So the one that I'm going to mention is the one that I'm working on myself, maybe perhaps selfishly. So at leverfund.org is an enterprise, a nonprofit enterprise that is getting going. It's based on the Robin Hood model in New York, which is a $150 million or so poverty fighting nonprofit that uses metrics to measure the impact of what they do, which is grant out to other nonprofits to help them further their missions. And it's all based on a calculation about how much do you raise someone's lifetime earnings. So that model has been copied into Chicago and San Francisco, and I and three other co-founders are trying to bring that to the DC metro area. We're definitely looking for board members and contributors and suggestions about other nonprofits that we should be supporting. So I'll call that one out.
And when you say it's not like you're not affiliated with that organization though. You're just taking that concept and
I'm affiliated in that I'm a founder.
No, the Robin Hood Foundation.
Yeah, no, we're not. Although one of our other founders was an employee of theirs in New York for a number of years. But yeah, we're not. We are working, you know, with their blessing, but as a different
enterprise. Using their model and applying it here. And what are the steps? Where are you currently in that process?
We've formed a board, although it's probably not entirely complete. We've started raising money. We've hired an executive director. We're we are on our way to our first grants, but haven't made any yet.
So you're going to grant directly to C3s?
Yes.
As DMV area, DC only?
DMV, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Or we'll, I mean, you're in the perfect location.
And part of this is from talking with other business owners over the last decade or more, you know, a lot of people who I see as wealthy don't necessarily see themselves as wealthy because you can always look up and see someone with a lot more.
Especially in D.C.
Especially anywhere, right? You know, anywhere where there's an inequality, right, which is hard to point out a place where there isn't. So I'm trying to get my peers involved, so there's philanthropy at the very high end, the 100 millionaires and the billionaires, and those people are hard to reach, and not too many of them are my friends. So I'm trying to bring a new class of philanthropists in with my co-founders, and we've had some luck with that and are working on it further. Of course, we'll be happy to bring in a few billionaires as well.
So you're holding dinner parties and asking people to...
I've done mostly one-on-one outreach, but we're trying a variety of the methods that you use. Yes, mostly by adding people to the board who have their own connections and can help.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you for stopping by.
My pleasure.
I learned a lot. I've got some more questions I'm going to ask you. I'll send them to you in an email.
All right.
Yeah, thank you for all the tangents. And before you leave, I got to see if you've got a business card on you.
I probably do. I'll be happy to give you one.
I just want to see it.
Okay, I'll check. I don't always carry it.
Thanks. No.
Cheers.